Fiercely independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for the world at www.kpfk.org. Support free speech and freeform radio. Peace.
Both, I hope. Welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, the co-host of the show. Well, my goodness, it's been a busy time in the courts. So we're having one of our special shows where we focus on what has been going on in the courts. I mean, in recent days, the federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have been busy ruling on Trump's actions. The High Court has sadly allowed Trump to proceed with the removal of 350,000 Venezuelans, with only Justice Jackson dissenting. The High Court did, however, extend the freeze on Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act for deportations. It is an important ruling on birthright citizenship, which we'll discuss on the show today, received an emergency appeal over mass firings, and considered the administration's complaint that local federal district court judges were wrongfully issuing rulings purporting to apply nationwide. All of this and more will be discussed if you stay tuned. Maria, how are you doing?
Yes, I'm great, Jim. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. Let me introduce our guest and we'll get started with it.
Great.
We once again, of course, turn to our local constitutional experts when we do these special shows in order to discuss some of the more important court decisions of recent days or weeks. And our regular guest for this topic is, of course, Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a constitutional scholar, a writer, lecturer, and political activist. He is the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, the past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. Mr. Rohde is a founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Of course, Steve Rohde is speaking only for himself today. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Well, thank you so much, Jim and Maria. These meetings together with our audience are a real opportunity for me to dig deep into these issues. And literally, court rulings are coming down every single day, including this morning.
Yes, indeed. And you've been doing some wonderful writing about it, I should mention, as well in the LA Progressive and elsewhere. Well, Steve, sadly, the Supreme Court has issued a ruling allowing Trump to proceed with the removal of 350,000 Venezuelans. So please talk to us first about this Venezuelan case, but then talk to us as well about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that did extend the freeze on Trump's use of that old Alien Enemies Act.
Yes, the Supreme Court giveth and taketh away. This decision on the Venezuelans is probably the worst ruling we have had from the Supreme Court since Trump returned to office. We've been discussing these cases over the last several months, but this one really sets a terrible precedent. The background on this is clear. That in 1990, the temporary protected status situation was granted to the Director of Homeland Security with the power to designate countries where citizens cannot return safely due to a natural disaster, armed conflict, or extraordinary and temporary conditions. And under the Biden administration, 350 million Venezuelans received temporary protected status because of the turmoil going on in Venezuela. Now, despite the Trump administration labeling these as criminals and worse, 50% of these Venezuelans have college degrees, 95% are employed, Some have American children that have been born during the time they were protected by the TPS program. And under that program, anyone convicted of a misdemeanor is not eligible for that status in any event. So back on March 31st, Judge Edward Chen in the Northern District of California stayed Donald Trump's executive order, in which with the mark of a Sharpie, President Trump abolished those $350,000 temporary protected statuses. Mm-hmm. He said, the judge, that individual Venezuelans are protected, and that was going to be the status, that we would maintain the status quo pending the outcome of this litigation as it works its way through the courts. The Ninth Circuit refused to stay Judge Chen's order. They kept it in effect. Yet it came before the United States Supreme Court. And this Monday, only 2 days ago, the Supreme Court cleared the way while the litigation is pending, affecting these 350,000 people to allow Trump to move ahead to proceed to deport them and revoke their status. This was less than a page, this order. It is, there is no reasoning. There is no explanation. It does say that individual Venezuelans can bring separate actions to challenge Kristi Noem's, the Secretary of Homeland Security, if she seeks to terminate their work permits or remove them from the U.S. Separate proceedings. They're inviting 350,000 separate legal proceedings with all that it takes to find a lawyer, to pay for a lawyer, to prepare such a case. And the only dissent, public dissent in this ruling on Monday was from Justice Jackson. Not even Justice Sotomayor or Kagan indicated, at least, their dissent. And often judges show their dissent. So it's very troubling in that regard. It's a real clear sign of the cruelty of both what the Trump administration is doing. SCOTUS is considering other emergency appeals by Trump to lift injunctions for non-citizens to stay in the United States for humanitarian reasons. There are more than 500,000 here protected from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. All of those cases are now in doubt. This is the most sweeping ruling by the Supreme Court in this respect, because it does disrupt the status quo. The status quo was the temporary protected status was in place protecting these individuals. Trump has disrupted the status quo. What injunctions do and what the lower courts have done is preserve the status quo. It is classic equity jurisprudence. And instead, the Supreme Court has swept in and tipped that balance.
And did they, now, Steve, if I may, I gather they offered no reasoning for their decision?
None. It is the most sanitized ruling. You can read it in three sentences. It just says, we're doing this. Now, there's no indication whether they will. Sometimes they issue additional. Now, they've had this case for weeks. There's no emergency in that sense. It simply maintained the status quo. So now the only glimmer is that for Sotomayor and Kagan to say this, maybe, in other words, to not dissent, maybe something is in the works there, and Kagan and Sotomayor are trying to curry favor and build a majority on the merits of the case in some way. That's my wishful thinking as far as that's concerned.
Well, let's hope. And then there's the upright citizenship case.
Well, let me get to the second part of your first question, which is Alien Enemies Act. Now, this was good news because on May 16, the court 7-2, and with only Alioto and Thomas indicating their dissent, that means they got seven of the conservatives. They got four of the conservatives and three of the liberals to join in this. Now, that this one, they did use reasoning and analysis. They issued about a 10-page opinion. Now, it was devoted to the question of whether the stay on the deportation of these Venezuelan nationals who are being accused of being members of the Tien de Aragua, the TDA gang, and the government, Trump has designated them alien enemies under the law we've talked about in the past, written in 1798, dragged into this case by Trump and his DOJ. Already judges, lower court judges, have ruled that we're not in a state of war with Venezuela, that Venezuela as a country has not invaded us, and that there's no incursion. And so on the merits, that is what the lower courts are saying. Now, in this decision on May 16, the Supreme Court did not reach the Alien Enemies Act itself. They said that's pending further litigation. But the good news is that pending that decision on the merits, they stayed and issued their own injunction preventing the removal to that dreadful prison in El Salvador of these individuals. Now, what's worth taking a moment on this case is how the seven judges stood up to Alito and Thomas. The dissent by Alito and Thomas is one of the most deceptive, dishonest opinions I've read. Sadly, I'm beginning to get used to those decisions as far as Alito is concerned. He tortured the facts, and the majority called him on it. He tried to say, well, there's no urgency. There's no risk that these men will be shipped off to El Salvador, when the majority points out that in the court hearings, the Trump lawyers would not commit by the very next day. This was a late night hearing. They would only commit that day not to remove them. They reserve the right to remove them the very next day. Now, you know, we've all practiced law quite some time, the three of us. I've never seen a more imminent, irreparable risk than a government lawyer saying, we reserve the right to do this tomorrow. And that wasn't enough for Alito. He always dresses up his opinions with lots of legal shenanigans and legalisms. But the majority in that case, at least, saw through that. The deportations in that case are on hold. And I believe on the merits, because of the thoughtful lower court's opinions, that Alien Enemies Act will be found to not apply and not give Trump the power he's claiming.
Excellent.
Well, I know Jim was wondering about the birthright citizenship issue. There was an argument in the Supreme Court over Trump's attempt to do away with birthright citizenship in the United States. So, Steve, tell us, what is birthright citizenship, and what did the justices have to say about this critically important constitutional issue this week?
Yes, this was an oral argument on May 15. In order to serve you better, I got up very early in the morning to watch and listen to the Supreme Court argument back in Washington, D.C. Now, Later, we'll talk about these national injunctions, because much of that oral argument had to do with the national injunctions. And the birthright citizenship issue took a back seat. But it couldn't disappear from the argument. Trump has cooked up, going back to his days when he accused Barack Obama of not being a citizen for other reasons. They've cooked up the notion that under the 14th Amendment, you must, if you're born in on the territorial limits of the United States, you have to be born to parents of American citizens at the time. That is at conflict with the language of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment establishes citizenship based on birth in the United States. It says that. Now, it says in the United States, subject to the laws of the United States. Trump and others have pointed out, well, the babies of diplomats sitting in an embassy somewhere are physically born in the United States, but they're not U.S. citizens. Well, that's very clear. They are in special status in an embassy, which is actually considered the property of the foreign country. In fact, they have immunity from our laws because of that. So that was a red herring. Courts below have struck down Trump's executive order to try to strip these individuals born in the United States of birthright citizenship. The court will take that up head on as those cases come through the lower courts. I really hope, and it's partly a hope, that Justice Roberts and his legacy, he does not want his legacy to have been to overturn the 14th Amendment, which has been recognized for centuries, and that we may get on the merits a unanimous decision, but hope is all we have when it comes to the justices like Alito, Thomas, and even Gorsuch.
Yes, indeed. Well, also just a few days ago, as you say, this is happening every day, but just a few days ago, Trump brought an emergency appeal regarding those mass firings. He brought this emergency appeal to the Supreme Court, you know, all those tens of thousands of people fired, federal employees fired at Musk's direction. What's been happening in the lower courts that prompted Trump to take this action? What is the issue the Supreme Court's going to be deciding?
A very, very important case affecting tens of thousands of federal employees. In February, shortly after coming to office, Trump issued an executive order instructing federal agencies to initiate large-scale reductions in force. They're known as RIFs, reduction in force. No real reason for that other than his ultimate reason in everything, which is to reduce government spending so he can grant huge tax cuts to the rich and to corporations. Well, good lawyers went to court, and on May 9, Judge Susan Alston, U.S. District Judge, issued a TRO prohibiting the administration from proceeding with any of these RIFs. Now, the Ninth Circuit has set a briefing schedule, which actually ends tomorrow, May 22nd, a day before the TRO is set to expire. So the system was proceeding as it should, but last Friday, tempted by the rulings the DOJ is winning occasionally, they asked the Supreme Court to stay that TRO in an emergency appeal. This has been the 15th request for emergency relief since Trump took office about 16 months ago. And they alternatively asked for what's called an administrative stay while the court considers the emergency stay. The Trump administration has these applications on speed dial. They press a button, they print out an application, they change the names, and they ask for the Supreme Court to intervene. And if it wasn't for that last case I discussed, I would have been more hopeful that the court would deny this stay. But that one, we're just going to have to wait and see what the high court does.
Mm-hmm. What is the issue, though, the Supreme Court will be deciding in that case specifically?
The question is whether the RIFs can be granted in furtherance of national security. So it's another example of Trump trotting out this scary exemption for national. Everything is national security when it comes to what he wants to do. And that's what's being litigated in the lower courts.
Great. Thank you.
Well, Steve, as you mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court considered the Trump administration's argument that local federal judges exceeded their authority by temporarily blocking some of his policy moves for the whole country, rather than simply within the district of the particular U.S. District Court. Can you explain that case to us?
Yes. District courts, you know, these are the individual, there are over 900 district judges around the country, are presented with legal issues. Specific plaintiffs come before them, or a class action may be certified when similarly situated parties raise an issue with them. And on occasion, and not in every case, based on the issues, a court will issue a national injunction when the issues are uniform, when there is a single issue presented. Courts, and these have been upheld for decades. Others have been reversed on the merits, etc. But universally, national injunctions are a feature of our federal court system. Now, in this case, in the birthright citizenship case, I believe it's the worst test case for the Trump administration, because you are interpreting the 14th Amendment, which applies to the entire United States, and you are testing it under a single set of facts, which is children born to immigrants and others, even those whose status is being litigated. So you have a uniform, a single issue, and a uniform set of individuals. And courts around the country have been granting these national injunctions. So the case made it way. This one got to the Supreme Court on May 15. And the Solicitor General, who's a new Solicitor General chosen by Donald Trump, he was Donald Trump's lawyer in previous cases, made some of the most convoluted, extenuating arguments that instead of national injunctions in appropriate cases, only class actions or individual lawsuits, we're back to that again, that each person questioning their child's birth and their citizenship should bring separate lawsuits around the country. The oral argument was really engaging to watch. Justice Sotomayor is very clever in these arguments. And I really encourage people, when you see C-SPAN listing a Supreme Court argument, excuse me, I would encourage you to watch it. Because very briefly, to test this issue, Sotomayor imagined a law that confiscated guns in the United States. Of course, she picks an issue that would test the mettle of the Trump administration. And she said, now let me get this straight, Solicitor General. Everyone who's had their gun confiscated under this single law should bring a separate lawsuit all across the country, and multiplicity of lawsuits. So she really put him on the spot. Later, even Justice Coney Barrett, a conservative, pressed the Solicitor General, are you going to follow court decisions around the country until they are appealed and ruled on by this court? And the Solicitor General waffled. He said, we generally follow circuit court precedent. He gave them a lot to chew on. I think they will find a way to uphold the availability of national injunctions. They may tighten it up. I do not think they are going to issue a flat ban on national injunctions. And I think that's going to be very important in this period, because so many of the disruptions that Trump is causing have been held back by these national injunctions.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of 900 separate lawsuits, which is the potential, of course, ludicrous. Two more cases of considerable importance. Just last Friday, again, a federal court judge told the Trump administration lawyers that it did not accept their argument for invoking, as they had in the case, the State Secrets Act as a reason for not telling the judge about its supposed efforts to facilitate the return from El Salvador prison, which is holding Kelmar Abrego Garcia, mistakenly deported and sent to that prison. Remember, the Supreme Court had ordered what it ordered, and now here you have a federal court judge unhappy with the fact that the lawyers representing the Trump administration have basically refused or made no reasonable argument invoking for invoking the State Secret Act. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, this is an intersection of some very dangerous privileges that the government has cooked up over the last several years. And one of them is this state secrets privilege, as they call it. So as you've indicated, and as listeners know by now, Kelmar Abrego Garcia, sent mistakenly by the admission of the government, that mistakenly sent to that terrible prison in El Salvador. Last Friday, now that case has been pending because the Supreme Court said that Garcia's return should be facilitated by the Trump administration. And Judge Paula Zinnes said that it not only needs to be facilitated, but that what steps, she asked the government lawyers, what steps are you taking to comply with both her order and the Supreme Court's order? And those government lawyers have been stonewalling her. She allowed Abrego Garcia's lawyers to conduct discovery, depositions, document requests. They are blocking 1,140 documents from being produced. In some cases, they will not even show the documents to the judge in her chambers outside of public view, which is done on occasion. The government lawyers say we're unable to comply because of the state secrets doctrine and what they call deliberative process privilege. And the judge said there is simply no detail. This is basically take my word for it, and she will have none of it. She's ordering a further hearing this week. That state secrets doctrine appears nowhere in the rules of federal procedure. It has never been adopted by Congress, which approves all the rules regulating our federal courts. It's been developed by government lawyers that whenever a lawsuit gets close to exposing government wrongdoing, they shout, state secrets, don't go any further, judge. And many judges, sadly, have bought that in cases in the last few decades, even going back to George Bush's terrible actions that he took. And they also have this deliberative process privilege, which is you can't take discovery of government officials' internal thinking. Well, no one cares about their internal thinking. We're trying to find out who ordered this man to be shipped out, who was involved in the decision, and what are the grounds for the decision. And if anything raises any national security concerns, it can be heard by the judge in chambers, and then she can decide what to make public. I am just so proud of lawyers like Abrego Garcia's lawyers and other lawyers and judges who are simply not tolerating what the government lawyers are doing.
Another case related in some ways, and this just happened Monday, 2 days ago, a federal appeals court rejected a request from the Trump administration to put on hold a federal district judge's order requiring the government to facilitate the return of a 20-year-old Venezuelan refugee who had been deported earlier this year as well to El Salvador. Talk to us about that case.
Yeah, this is a very important example. The case itself may not be gaining as much attention as some of the other cases have. There is a 20-year-old Venezuelan. In the court papers, he's only identified as Christian. He came to the United States under the program of unaccompanied minors, and who have then later sought asylum. Now, what is so aggravating about this case, and
excuse
that's
me,
what...
Excuse me, hold on. I apologize, it's my mistake. I lost track of the, listening to you, I lost track of the timing. And
sure.
I want to make sure you have adequate time, and we're really at a point where we need to pause briefly for station identification. So we will do that, we'll be right back with you. So hold those thoughts.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
Well, and we are back with you. That was a short ID break. We're right back with you. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty along with Maria Hall, and we're interviewing our guest, as we do periodically on the show, every couple of weeks, really, when we canvass the court decisions in the federal court, local district courts, appellate courts, the Supreme Court, and we have Steve Rohde on, who is our expert on these matters. And we're doing that again today. Steve, I asked you a question and it got interrupted because of my lack of paying attention to the clock. So start over again, if you wouldn't mind, and tell people what we're talking about at this moment.
Sure. Just briefly, it's a case that needs more attention than it's getting. A 20-year-old Venezuelan Christian is the only way they've identified him. Now, he was protected, and what is so egregious about the government is that in many cases, such as the Abrego Garcia case, in which they admitted that individual was shipped out by mistake, in this case, there was a class action settlement on behalf of individuals who entered the United States as unaccompanied minors and later sought asylum. This was a court stipulation and settlement. It was agreed to in 2024. It is a binding settlement, binding on the government and the parties. In spite of that, the government shipped this Venezuelan off in violation of the very settlement the government agreed to. And Judge Stephanie Gallagher, who is a Trump appointee, and we're beginning to see this, the number of judges, scores of judges now have been ruling on these cases across the country. And several of them are Trump judges who are taking their oath of office, their fidelity to the Constitution, much more seriously than Trump is taking his oath, let alone his underlings in his cabinet. So Trump sought a stay of that injunction. It's an injunction that the individual has yet to be removed. And fortunately, after Stephanie Gallagher, the Trump judge, issued the ruling, 2-1, The Fourth Circuit denied Trump a stay of that injunction. Judge Deandra Gist Benjamin, a Biden appointee, and Roger Gregory, a Clinton appointee, rejected Trump's request to lift that injunction. And in the case of Judge Gregory, he pointed out that as is becoming far too common, and I'm quoting him, "We are confronted again with efforts of the executive branch to set aside the rule of law in pursuit of its goals." I mean, you can't be clearer than that. That is not Steve Rohde on Trump. That's not even Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall. That is a circuit court, the second level of our federal court system, saying that. Now, in dissent was Judge Julius Richardson, a Trump appointee, here, unfortunately, in lockstep. That judge said that the district judge had exceeded her authority. And listen to this argument by this Trump appellate judge, that it would be futile because to hold back this individual from being deported, given the near certainty his application for asylum would be denied. Now, we're talking a lot about due process these days. Due process assumes independent judges who do not prejudge a case in advance. This is the opposite of due process, for a sitting appellate judge to predict that a future application for asylum would be futile, and therefore, why give him any relief now? This is, to some extent, how, in small part, our system is being infected by the kind of anti-due process thinking that the Trump administration is peddling. And it's dangerous if it takes hold in the lower courts, let alone the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, and it is Alice in Wonderland. It literally is. The verdict first and then the trial. You know, I mean, it's silly. And corruption of legal principles. I'm sorry. Yes, Maria, please.
Oh, well, I wanted to make sure we have time for the collective bargaining and federal employees. So, Steve, last Friday, an appeals court allowed Trump's executive order to end collective bargaining for hundreds of thousands of federal employees to play out while the lawsuit in the lower federal court plays out. Talk to us about this case, please.
Yeah, this is distressing because now you have a lower court doing damage to the system of law. So back on April 25th, U.S. District Judge Paul Friedman enjoined key parts of Trump's March 27 executive order that had canceled the collective bargaining right of hundreds of thousands of federal employees in approximately three dozen federal agencies and departments where employees are represented by the National Treasury Employees Union. The union had argued that it would lose more than half of its revenues, its dues, and two-thirds of its membership unless the preliminary injunction were granted. And that's exactly, in a full and well-reasoned opinion, is what the district court, that's the lowest court in our federal system, Paul Friedman did. And of course, Trump goes to the appellate level and argues that he has to enforce his executive order to, quote, ensure strong national security. they simply trot out these talismanic words.
Yep.
They just say the word national security, and they hope everything to fall by the wayside. And sadly, sometimes they prevail. And in this case, on May 19, 2 days ago, the appellate court, in a 2-1 ruling, is allowing Trump's executive order to take effect. And what is somewhat confusing, if not hopeful here, is that Trump's lawyers had agreed not to implement the key parts of the executive order as the litigation plays out. Now, how can the government argue that the injunction will cause irreparable injury when the government itself is voluntarily imposing that same restraint? How their voluntary restraint plays into their the green light they got to impose their firing, that really has to be played out. This was only decided on the 19th. And of all things, the majority, these two, this was a Trump judge and a George H.W. Bush judge, and the majority with a Biden judge, Michelle Childs, in dissent. But the majority also complained that the district judge failed to require a bond. Now, some injunctions in our world, you have to put up a bond if you're causing monetary damage to the other side in civil litigation and all the rest. The notion that a government needs a bond just to continue to employ people and to use collective bargaining, which they've used for decades, is a ludicrous argument. Unfortunately, this case has seen some green light as far as Trump is concerned. There's no indication yet whether the National Treasury Employees Union will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in this case, hoping they would reinstate a restraint against Trump. That just remains to be seen.
Well, you know, you pointed out that their argument, how specious their argument is about national security and just pulling out these talismans because they sound good. And yet, by allowing the negotiations to continue, they're undercutting their own argument that it's a threat to national security, are they not?
Yes. I mean, much of this makes very little sense when you dig beyond the labels. We can see that we are just not out of the woods. Lower court judges and Supreme Court judges are buying some of these arguments. And that's why, not to hold it till the end, these lawsuits are necessary but aren't sufficient,
right,
in terms of protest and resistance.
Indeed. Well, Steve, a case of considerable public interest, and it raises some interesting issues, does it not, is the case of Judge Hannah Dugan, that local Milwaukee judge. Now, she's been accused of obstructing federal ICE agents, immigration agents, by actions that she took in her courtroom. Now, she's entered a plea of not guilty. Remind our audience of the facts of this case, and does she have a good defense, you think, to the charges against her?
Yeah, this is a very, very troubling case. I want to link it to how the government is going after a congresswoman, alleging that she assaulted and committed battery against an ICE agent when she was trying to protect people outside a building, as well as the mayor of that city, although those charges were dropped. This is one of the most aggressive frontal attacks by the Department of Justice, not only against immigrants and others, but and not only against lawyers, but now against elected officials and judges. Hannah Dugan is a longstanding 66-year-old state judge in Milwaukee. She was presiding over a hearing of an individual who'd been charged with a crime. She had that proceeding pending in her state courtroom. ICE agents and DOJ, with DOJ support, arrived in her courtroom. Unless this changes in this era, judges control their courtrooms. All three of us have been in courtrooms. The power and authority of a sitting judge in their courtroom is virtually absolute. Of course, they can't commit any crimes themselves sitting there. But certainly the conduct of people in their courtroom is within their control. These ICE agents were waving some kind of documentation. She told Judge Hannah Dugan, told them to go down the hall to show their paperwork to the senior judge that administers those courtrooms. She conducted her hearing. This was Eduardo Flores Ruiz, a Mexican national who was in court on battery charges, and she was dealing with those criminal charges themselves. She was concerned what could be happening out in the public hall, in the outside the courtroom, the hallway, the public hallway. So she ushered the lawyer and Mr. Flores Ruiz around through the jury door, which went through a hallway and opened back up to the public hallway. At that point, apparently the agents did not capture the individual in the hallway as they were expecting to do. They did capture him outside the courthouse. Judge Dugan was arrested, and now a grand jury. They went to a grand jury. It's been said you could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. They indicted Judge Dugan on charges of concealing a person from arrest and obstruction of proceedings. She has lawyers who are defending her. She's pled not guilty. Sadly, and this is the sort of flip side of due process, the Wisconsin Supreme Court suspended Judge Dugan from presiding over any of her cases while this federal case is pending. The Wisconsin Supreme Court said it was to preserve public confidence in the court system. I'm not going to debate that. They saw a judge being charged with a crime and they suspended her. That's a loss to all the parties who are appearing before her, because everything I've read indicates she is a sound, thoughtful judge. But this is the toll it takes when a government moves against anyone that it opposes in society. She now has had to hire a lawyer. They will have to go through federal court proceedings. There will be motions to dismiss, citing her legal role in the acts that she took. But it has already taken a toll on her. It will take a further toll over the many months that this case is pending and whether it ever goes to trial and on to appeal. But it is, as far as I know, the first example of the Trump administration moving against a sitting judge. They've recommended impeachment and they've recommended other kinds of punishments, but this is the first criminal case.
And she's apparently a highly thought of judge there, much respected by the bar, whether they be liberal or conservative. She enjoys a good reputation. So the idea that she's some kind of loose cannon, of course, is silly as well.
Right. And as we all know, the, you know, usually the judges, they're the head of their courtroom. They can do what they want.
Yeah.
So we are running out of time is going so quickly today. But let's see. So, Steve, we have one last question we really want to get to, and that is about Mahmoud Khalil, the country's most prominent pro-Palestinian turned protester turned prisoner who's still in jail in Louisiana, waiting to see if he can be freed from jail while his immigration case proceeds. Why is this the case, and what are the issues the judge in his case has not yet ruled on? You're on mute.
Yes. I want to alert you, depending on time, that this morning a case broke on one of these deportations. And if we have a few minutes for that, I'll discuss that. But as far as Mahmoud Khalil, I know the audience does and should be familiar with him. The real question is, why is he still confined to that prison in Louisiana? Others have been released on bail. Yes. Badar Khan Suri, a Georgetown University student, was released after 58 days. Ms. Uzturk of Tufts was released after 45 days. And Motion Madawi of Columbia itself was released after 16 days. But Mr. Khalil, seized on March 9, remained 73 years later. The answer here has a lot to do with the district judge who has Khalil's case. It's Michael Farbarza, a judge who was appointed in 2023, former federal prosecutor in Manhattan, but a senior fellow at NYU Law School, and by all accounts considered a thoughtful, deliberate judge. So thoughtful and deliberate that he is taking months to consider the request for bail. This judge has issued a 67-page opinion on his right to preside over the case, an 108-page opinion that his control has not been stripped by other proceedings. But the Center for Constitutional Rights, that is representing Khalil, is arguing that this case needs to be expedited. Ultimately, the constitutionality of the Trump administration's attempt to deport Khalil under a 1952 McCarthyism law is what's at stake. And Judge Farbarza has the power to judge the constitutionality of the application of that case. There's a second case, an immigration case, pending in Louisiana, but that administrative judge only has the power to decide if the government met its legal burden to deport Khalil, assuming the law is constitutional. And there's a hearing tomorrow in that case. So from what I can understand, the Center for Constitutional Rights is showing great respect for the judge. They are being patient. They are submitting the necessary legal papers. But meanwhile, a man's liberty is at stake that by all accounts is only been incarcerated for exercising his free speech rights in protests at Columbia. Over last weekend, his supporters and his family held a people's graduation at Columbia University. Since the official ceremony, Mr. Khalil was unable to attend. At that people's graduation was his son Dean, born April 21st, a child that Khalil has yet to see and hold in his own hands. So we're hopeful that CCR can move, and really the judge will understand why expedition is so important in this case.
Indeed, indeed.
The other case, we have a few minutes?
We have two or three minutes anyway, I think.
All right. Well, I just wanted to add this today because it's ripped from the headlines. This morning, Judge Brian Murphy in Boston was holding a hearing, and he had issued an order in April, and he said that the government must provide at least 15 days notice to any immigrant being deported to a country not their own to allow for challenges based on credible fears they would face danger if sent to a third country. He demanded, the judge insisted and ordered the government to provide 15 days notice. Well, guess what? Late 2 days ago, with 24 hours notice, giving eight men from Cuba, Laos, Mexico, Burma, Vietnam, were flown on the way to South Sudan, a country that is in turmoil and on the brink of civil war. So far, they landed in Djibouti. We don't know their actual presence at the moment. The judge was beside himself. He had already told these lawyers and these parties. He said that 24 hours was insufficient, and he said the following: the department's actions in this case are unquestionably violative of this court's order, and that they could result in criminal contempt. He demanded a list of the names of every Trump official involved so he can notify them that they may face criminal penalties. This is the fourth time officials have been accused of bending or violating Judge Murphy's orders, and that joins a long list of judges whose orders have been skirted or violated. Judge James Boasberg, Paula Zinnes, we talked about, Stephanie Gallagher. This is literally how this administration is addressing these courts. And at the lower level, they have the power of criminal contempt, civil contempt. And if the Department of Justice, which is the arm of the courts when it comes to contempt of court, but think of the irony of asking Pam Bondi and the Department of Justice to proceed with criminal contempt of these Trump officials that are flaunting the law. Well, guess what? Under the federal rules of civil procedure, these judges can appoint a private attorney to prosecute civil and criminal contempt. And I think the next time we meet, we may be on the verge of criminal contempt proceedings being filed against these officials, and legal action and disciplinary action being taken against the lawyers themselves.
And it's about time, frankly. I mean, I understand why, for political reasons, the judges go slow in such matters, but my God, the contempts are so clear here in some of these cases that one would hope that they would now proceed and not just threaten the same. Well, I guess we are done for the day. We have 1 minute left? That's just enough time to thank you, Steve. Steve, where can people follow your writings?
Well, you've been so kind. I want to say that the three of us are co-hosts of Law and Disorder National Radio. Mm-hmm. Monday mornings, our new shows drop. I know that the show that's coming up this Monday will be impressive. I'm pleased that my podcast, Speaking Freely, a First Amendment podcast with Stephen Rohde on the Miz Studios Network, will be released June 5, and we will promote that to your listeners and others. Luckily, my writings, I have the benefit of LA Progressive and the rest.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone who's listened to us today. Our theme music will shortly be playing. There it is, I think. We want to thank you. I'm Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall. We thank you for listening today. We urge you to stay healthy, my friends. And as the music is about to tell you to pay attention to your rights and stand up for them. Story had never been told, so now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up, stand up.
I was turning the radio dial in the car, trying to find something other than the usual dribble and fluff and nothingness on the rest of the airwaves, and I just stumbled across KPFK, and I was just drawn to it like a magnet, and I was just listening to it intently. And all of a sudden, I said, I have got to pull off the freeway here. I found the nearest telephone booth. I called my wife and said, you have got to turn on 90.7 FM. I will talk to you when I get home. This is incredible. What I noticed was different right away was that people were being interviewed at length. And when they were talking about the purpose for the station, the reason for being was to promote understanding among peoples of all races and from all countries and all classes, and to provide information about the events of the world that were not reported.